The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and 106.7 in St. Paul. This is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman.
This program will inspire you, inform you, feed you healthy recipes, engage you politically, enlighten you spiritually. Help me name it. Now I'm no longer doubtful of what I'm living for. And if I make you happy, I don't need to do more. Cause you make me feel. You make me feel.
Go, girl.
Many of us look at life as work. We approach it and try to handle it like a job. We complain about it. We blame others when it's not working. We hold someone else responsible when it does not give us what we want. Some of us give up on life. We move from day to day with no plan, no goals, and ultimately no rewards. We fail to understand that if life is work, the better we do it, the better it will pay us. When we perform our tasks to the very best of our ability, we receive just rewards for what we do. When we are thorough in our work and put our best into it, we become better at it. When we become too good for where we are, we will be advanced to our rightful place. The things we must realize about life is it cannot be better until we are better. We cannot get more until we are more. The only thing that can stop our advancement in life is our not being ready to move. If life is work, run it like a multi-million dollar corporation and elect yourself Chief Executive Officer. Affirmation. The better I am at life, the better it gets. That comes from the book Acts of Faith, Iyanla Vincent.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, and 106.7 FM in St. Paul. And this is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman, and I'm Kinshasa. We're going to talk with Dr. David Simon. His book,
Free to Love, Free to Heal. Heal your body by healing your emotions. Doctor, how did this book come about?
In many ways, this book is the fruit of, you know, over 30 years of my work as a physician, in that, you know, my training as a conventional medical doctor was really to look at people as if they were bags of biochemicals. So when someone has a complaint, a symptom, a ticket that gets them into a doctor's office, the conventional physician is taught to think in terms of what biochemistry is out of balance, and then how do we recreate a new biochemistry by a pharmaceutical. So someone has heartburn, you don't think in terms of light stress, you think in terms of too many hydrochloric acid molecules. Someone has trouble sleeping, you're not thinking in terms of marital discord, you're thinking in terms of insufficient GABA. And if someone's depressed, the conventional training says it's not because your core relationships are not nourishing you or you've had a history of boundary violations as a child. It's an insufficiency of serotonin. And you know, what I've come to realize over really decades is that there's almost always a deeper story that underlies a challenge to our life and challenge to our health, either psychological or physical health. And that if we can get into that story, if we can tap into that story, if we can reveal that story that's almost always hidden in more subconscious levels of the mind, then that's the beginning of healing and transformation. And so really for, you know, the last decade, I've been exploring how do we make it safe enough for someone to awaken and access that story. And that's led to courses that I've been teaching now for many years, and then ultimately to this book.
You know, when you're talking about stories, there's been kind of a core misunderstanding about them. There's seems to be one school of thought that says that we really need to get beyond our stories, and another school of thought that suggests that we need to tell our stories over and over again. And one of the challenges, I think, somewhere between the two is that, and I think that one would choose to get beyond the story because they don't want to be re-traumatized by whatever that initial trauma was. And I'm just wondering, in your work, how do you see that?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. But if retelling a story re-traumatizes you, then that story is continuing to sabotage your happiness, whether or not you're bringing it into conscious awareness or not. You know, it's like if you think there's a boogeyman living in your closet, whether or not you open that closet door or not, that boogeyman is still scaring you. And so, you know, it's my experience that we need to open the closet. We need to bring those stories out more often than not, regardless of how painful or traumatizing they were at the time. Just because of the evolutionary nature of life, our ability to digest that experience becomes much greater with time. And so, you know, to say let's just get on with our lives, that's in many ways just saying let's just sweep it under the rug and pretend that it's not there. But inevitably, people will trip over that toxicity that's not been dealt with. So I do think the ultimate goal is to get on with it, to realize that whatever's happened in the past, we now at this moment have the capacity to start writing a new chapter, to creating a new screenplay for ourselves. But, you know, if someone is sensing that something from their past is no longer serving them in the present, telling them just get over it almost never really works. And, you know, if we could, it would be great. The closest thing we have to it is, you know, take some Prozac. But what we know is that as soon as you stop the Prozac, the underlying feelings return because you haven't done the deeper work of identifying, mobilizing, and clearing out that emotional toxicity.
In your work, have you found that there's one way that is more effective than another in being able to start to release these stories, to release these things that we've hidden on the inside?
you know, I think that there is a elegant process that addresses the core challenges that most people who are being restricted by emotional pain from the past can employ, obviously based upon a person's individual experience and their makeup. Some will be more effective than others. But, you know, in general, the process that I find to be the most useful, which is why we use it at the Joper Center and why I wrote the book about it, involves a certain level of withdrawing from your world, at least for a few days. You know, in the traditional yoga traditions, there's a step along the path known as pratyahara, which means withdrawing the senses from outside and going within. And, you know, it's sometimes hard to get free of emotional pain if you're in the world and still dealing with conflicted relationships. So, you know, there's a real value in saying, I'm going to take a few days off and get to a place where you're not being called upon to respond or react in the predictable ways. And then go within. You know, meditation is a key component of quieting down the inner dialogue and really listening to the conversation of the heart, which is always whispering. It's never shouting at us. You know, in that quiet space, withdrawing from the usual concerns and challenges of life, quieting down the mind in yoga practice and meditation, then centering in the heart, we begin the process by simply asking our hearts, you know, what am I carrying with me from my past that's no longer serving me in the present? I think it's, you know, the most important question to start this process of emotional purification, emotional detoxification. And then if you've prepared for it and have taken the time to quiet and give it the attention, then your heart will start to reveal. It'll tell you the stories and it will bring you the feelings. And you know, so what we usually do in our programs and what I recommend in the book is that you listen to it for a while, you feel it and you listen, and then you start writing about it. That journaling seems to have a very profound effect on taking this information that's buried deep within our soul and bringing it out to a place where we can now truly heal it. So there's a process of identifying what we're carrying with us. There's a process of mobilizing, and in my experience, the most powerful way to mobilize emotional toxicity is to share it with people that we trust. So that could be a therapist or a counselor or a clergy member or a dear friend or family member. It could be a professional person. You know, at the courses that we teach, the Free to Love courses that we teach, we have people pair up, and with total strangers in this very safe, loving, guided context, people will expose themselves in ways that they're not usually willing to express that vulnerability. But that mobilizes it. So rather than keeping it hidden deep within our heart and soul, we start talking about it. And there's tremendous value in talking about it, particularly if the people with whom we're sharing it are established in a state of non-judgment. One of the values is just in the process of mobilizing, we start to feel free. Another is that we realize that everybody has their own stories and that we're not alone, even though sometimes we may feel that we're the only ones who are going through this kind of pain. Because it's generally not something that's discussed in polite company. And then, so that's the second step. That's the third step. The first step is to prepare for it. So we prepare by meditation, by withdrawing from the usual worldly concerns, by doing yoga to get connected to our bodies. We identify by asking these questions and journaling the experiences that come into awareness. We mobilize by sharing our stories, and then we very consciously encourage people to go through a releasing ritual. You know, so what we do at our courses, we literally pack people on buses and take them down to the beach here in San Diego, and we have them gather up rocks along the shore, and as they're reviewing their stories in their mind and feeling the sensations in their body, we encourage them as a ritual to download all the pain into the rock that they're holding in their hand against their heart. And when that rock is fully loaded up, then we tell them to heave that rock into the ocean. Just throw it away with lots of vigorous sounds as a demonstration that we're not going to live without love anymore, that whatever's happened in the past, we can create a new future. And so we go through that process. It usually takes about an hour. And, you know, we should take before and after pictures because the sense of lifting of a burden is so profound when people are willing to activate their minds and their bodies with the intention of releasing. So that's the fourth step. And then the fifth step is to begin now consciously writing the next chapter, making the commitments that whatever's happened in the past, moving forward, we will act as if we deserve happiness, as if we deserve love, as if we deserve to take good care of ourselves, as if we have a meaning and purpose in life that we deserve to express in the world. And we find that in a very short time, even if someone's been carrying pain for decades, that there's a real sense of light, of lightning, you know, of enlightening. The heart feels lighter. The creativity begins to flow again. The sense of being worthy and lovable is rekindled. So it doesn't take long, and then it allows us to really move on to that path of awakening.
We're talking with Dr. David Simon. Dr. Simon is the co-founder of the Chopra Center. His new book, Free to Love, Free to Heal. You talk about moving from healing to awakening. Can you talk about awakening, Dr. Simon?
Awakening is celebrating this extraordinarily mysterious, miraculous opportunity to see the world, see the universe through a human nervous system. You know, it's, you know, we take it for granted, but, you know, if we step back just for a moment and think about how improbable it is that we are even here for this short time and what an amazing creation nature is, you know, with all of its abundance and its change and its diversity and its sounds and sensations and sights and tastes and smells, that, you know, to be wallowing in suffering is to be missing, you know, this amazing experience. And so we want people to dump the pain, you know, to unchain themselves from the weights that they're carrying with them, to release the emergency brake that they're driving with, so that they can really say, hey, life is amazing. Let's celebrate. Let's really enjoy it. Let's keep looking for the deeper meaning, the deeper truth. Let's come into this space with an open heart and an enthusiastic mind. And that's really, you know, what the spiritual path is. The spiritual path is increasingly embracing the miracle of existence. And, you know, so we don't want to waste that time. We don't want to spend the whole time agonizing, anguishing over things that have happened to us in the past, because then it'll be over with and all we'll be left with is regret. It's like people who go to a restaurant and after they order and have been eating for a while, one person says, you know, this is a really bad meal. The food is cold. It's not spiced very well. And the other one says, you're right, and the portions are so small. And unfortunately, a lot of people live their life that way, that they're perpetually complaining about what's happening, but at the same time terrified that it's going to be over with. And it's not a good way to live our lives.
KFAI is proud to present Louise Post at 7th Street Entry on Friday, March 22nd. For the past three decades, Louise Post has been the co-frontwoman of the celebrated act Veruca Salt. She is now touring behind her latest solo album, Sleepwalker, an album that showcases the various aspects of Post's songwriting while still staying true to the distinctive niche she's carved out for herself through her work in Veruca Salt. Opening the show, local act Creeping Charlie. Tickets for Louise Post can be found at the First Avenue website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
We're talking with Dr. David Simon this evening on Health Notes. His important book, Free to Love, Free to Heal. Heal your body by healing your emotions. We talk about love a lot. It seems that that's what human beings are looking for. But the thing that's really interesting to me is that I don't know that we have any clear definitions of love. And I was just wondering, how do you define love?
Love is that call from separation to unity. You know, so every one of us, now, since we are individuated, we are individuals, we have our own personalities, you know, which of course is wonderful. It's great that we all have our own I, me, mine, and our own desires and our own memories and our own choices. But inherent in our separation is the memory of unity. You know, whether or not you look at the world from a quantum physics perspective or a cosmological perspective that says that, you know, in the beginning, the entire universe was compressed into an infinitesimally small point of infinitesimal density, and then for reasons that only nature knows, the Big Bang occurred, and everything that we see now is form and phenomenon, although it has its own individuality, you know, is really the expression of that underlying unity. Or, you know, we just see it in our own lives that deep within us there's this call to connect. And love is what we call that. When love is that impulse that takes us from separation to unity. And, you know, regardless of where you are in your life, there's always that intrinsic impulse to move from individuation to unification. So, you know, when a 5-year-old says, "I love my teddy bear," what they're saying is, through my connection to this inanimate object, I feel safer. I feel more whole. You know, when a 17-year-old gets a new car and says, "I love my car," it's because through that connection, they feel more part of things. You know, and when you say, "I love my partner," "I love my job," it's the same thing. And so ultimately, love at every level of life is the wave of life that takes us from the pangs of separation to the bliss of unity. And so in every moment, on some level, there is this call to unity. You know, subatomic particles congregate as atoms because of love, and atoms form molecules because of love, and molecules form bodies because of love, and bodies form relationships and communities because of love. The moon keeps circulating around the earth because of love. So love is that unifying force that permeates everything in nature, everything in the universe, and really every cell in our body.
In chapter 9, you talk about the practice of love and apparently making love a way of life. It's pretty interesting on one hand, and I really appreciate the definition that you just gave of love. It's something that we long for so much. We acknowledge on one hand how powerful it is, and on another hand, we're afraid to really express it in fear of being hurt or seeming vulnerable. How do we go about the practice of love?
Well, first of all, we realize that everybody is thinking the way that you just said. So everybody wants to be loved, everyone wants to give love, and everyone is afraid to love. So, you know, somebody's got to step up to the plate. One of my favorite poets is Hafez, a great Sufi mystic from the 14th century. And he says, "Admit something." One of his poems says, "Admit something. Everyone you meet, you say, 'Love me.' Of course, you don't say this out loud, otherwise someone would call the cops. But consider this deep need in us to connect. So knowing this, why not you be the one with those full moon eyes saying in that sweet moon language what every other heart is longing to hear?" So, you know, there's actually a practice to make to help people become more comfortable being loving. And that is, you start by just looking yourself in the mirror. So you literally make eye contact with yourself in the mirror. And while you're looking at yourself in the mirror, which is always kind of an interesting exercise anyways, because you can't help but, when you look at yourself in the mirror, thinking, who am I or who is this person? But independent of that, you make eye contact and you say to yourself, I am beneath no one. I am but above no one because I am the universe. And then the word in Sanskrit for that expression or experience is namaste. Namaste, probably people have heard. It's the expression that says the being in me recognizes the being in you and knows that it's the same being. So for a while, every time you walk by a mirror, you look yourself in the eye and you say, beneath no one, above no one, I am the universe, namaste. And then you start practicing that same exercise when you look into other people's eyes. So just very briefly, even if you just say namaste internally, silently, you're reminding yourself that you are the same being in disguise. And that very simple act of connecting, you know, having that heart-opened intention when you look into someone's eyes, starts the flow of love. And if you practice it, you'll see how it changes people very subconsciously. You know, if you go to a busy restaurant and you can see the waiter or waitress are really stressed because everyone's yelling at them and demanding things. When they finally come to your table, if you just look the waitress or waiter in the eye for 1 second and have the thought, namaste, immediately their body language will change. They'll take a breath. They'll stop looking stressed because what's happening is perhaps for the first time all evening or all day, someone is seeing them as a soul, as a being, rather than just as a servant. And something changes in us when we feel that level of connection. So that's a good starting point to be willing to go into that vulnerable space where love begins to flow. And the interesting thing about love is that it defies the usual laws of economics. You know, love and wisdom defy the usual laws of economics because most things, if you give it away, you have less of it. Until if you give it all away, you have none of it. But if you give your love away or you share your wisdom, you actually end up having more of it than when you started. And so just keep giving it away, and you'll see that nature loves a vacuum. You know, people say nature abhors a vacuum, but actually nature loves a vacuum. If you open up a space, nature will flow in there with love, creativity, abundance. So, you know, everyone's afraid to love. Just get over it.
As you'll always be. such joy I never knew I'd find.
I will
celebrate the victory.
Dr. David Simon on Health Notes tonight. Free to love, free to heal. Heal your body by healing your emotions. Why the order free to love, free to heal? Usually one would think that, I don't know why we would, why, I mean, as I'm asking you the question, I'm thinking, well, of course it would make sense that if I'm loving, then if I'm free to love, then I can heal. And usually I think that we view it the other way around. If I can heal, then I can love. How do you see that distinction?
A similar reversal is people think, if I heal myself, then I'll be happy. You know, if I get rid of this headache, then I'll be happy. If I you know, can cure my irritable bowel syndrome, then I'll be happy. But we actually find that it's more important to go for what makes you happy, and then the healing occurs. That sense of well-being, that sense of joy, that sense of pleasure, that sense of ecstasy is amazingly healing. And so when people, people come every week to the Chopra Center and participate in programs here with a whole range of illnesses and sufferings, and you know, they come thinking we're going to do something about their disease. We're going to do something about their cancer. We're going to do something about their ulcerative colitis. We're going to do something about their migraine headaches. But we really don't pay much attention to the disease when people are here. We give people the experience of joy. We help people through meditation, through yoga, through beautiful Ayurvedic treatments, through information, through interactive exercises, through dance, through movement, through artistic expression. We remind them of their capacity to create inner bliss, inner joy, inner ecstasy. And what they find is by focusing on happiness, their illness gets better. Their struggle gets less. And I think the same is true for love, is that if we think we have to be healthy in order to be able to love, well, we'll probably never be healthy and we'll never love. If we just say, what can I do today to expand love in my life? And you have your attention on that, most likely whatever the psychological or physical challenge that you're facing will become somewhat less. So, you know, love is that flow of energy that links the part to the whole. And almost all sickness is a result of that separation from wholeness. You know, a cancer cell is a cell that has taken on its own ego and doesn't care so much about how its choices influence its community. And so the way to cure cancer is to remind that cancer cell of its purpose in life, of its dharma, have it return its memory of wholeness, and then reestablish balance again. So, you know, one of my friends, Diane Connolly at Thai Sophia, wrote a book called All Sickness is Homesickness. And so the cure is to come back home. And of course, that doesn't mean the bricks and mortar of your structure, it means heart and soul of your being.
It's powerful. In your book, you have a lot of yoga positions, and you talk about movement. Where does movement fit into this conversation?
You know, the body is the subconscious mind. So whatever we're not aware of, in some way or another, we store that memory in our bodies. And that's certainly true for the memories of painful experiences, which, you know, come from either not getting our needs met or having our boundaries violated without our permission. So we store that. And often when we're hurt, the natural protective mechanism is to contract or to constrict. So, you know, if you imagine someone being beaten on the ground, they will tend to curl up into a fetal position to try to protect themselves. And it is protective, but that constricted, contracted posture also locks in pain. And in order to mobilize and release that pain, we have to begin to release that constriction. And movement is a powerful way, you know, getting people to tune into their bodies, feel the feelings. You know, music is a powerful tool to bring us into the present moment. And we provide those opportunities through yoga, through Tai Chi, through dance, for people to get back in touch with their bodies. And what we find is that it's an amazing way to begin to activate the internal pharmacy, that inner pharmacy that can create the chemistry of well-being, that can create the chemistry that supports our immune function, that normalizes our digestive tract, that helps us get into a normal sleep-wake cycle. So, you know, anybody who's listening, if they're struggling with something, think for a moment, what's your favorite music? Put it on, close the shades, and just let yourself dance freely and ecstatically, and you'll see that something changes, something shifts, something reminds you that life is short and shouldn't be wasted in ruminating about the past or worrying about the future, that we should be perpetually exploring this present moment.
You also talk about writing the great love story, or writing a great love story. Can you say more about that?
You know, love is the greatest teacher that we can experience. And, you know, no drop of love is ever wasted. You know, our personal love is just concentrated divine love. And so if we have that intention that every day we're going to write a love story, in whatever form it unfolds, you know, it could be being loving to our children, to our partners, to our spouses, to people that we work with, to our parents, to the neighbor next door, to the waiter that's serving us. You know, just having that intention to let love flow. There's no greater teacher. You know, patience is the disciple of love. Anyone who's in a loving relationship, you know, knows how important patience is. And so there's nothing else that can teach us about patience than as great as love. You know, unconditionality is the student of love. Unity is the student of love. So, you know, traditionally in the yoga tradition, there are four different pathways to unity. There's the path of knowledge, you know, Gyan Yoga. There's the path of action, Karma Yoga. There's the path of technology, Raja Yoga, and then there's the path of love, which is Bhakti Yoga. And it's not for everyone, but you know, if you are willing to practice love as a spiritual technology, you will very quickly get enlightened, because love is all about seeing through the differences and recognizing the underlying unity. And that's really the essence of higher states of consciousness, of awakening.
We're talking with Dr. David Simon this evening on Health Notes. His important book, Free to Love, Free to Heal, Heal Your Body by Healing Your Emotions. You end your book by talking about commitment to love. Although everything that you've talked about here certainly requires our commitment to love. Could you say a little bit more about that?
I wrote a book a couple years ago called The Ten Commitments, which was actually my reframing of the Ten Commandments, because I realized that whenever we're commanded to do something, it naturally brings up resistance. And at a certain point, the resistance gets so strong that we stop doing it. Whereas a commitment is really a promise to ourselves. It's a contract that we make with ourselves. It's a contract between our bodies, our minds, our hearts, and our soul. And a commitment says that this is I'm going to make these choices because this is who I want to be in the world. This is who I think I am and how I want to show up, not because I'm concerned what other people think or what other people expect, but because it's coming from the core of my being. And because ultimately, you know, I see people at all stages of life as a physician, and I see many people on their final days of life. You know, no one has any regrets about working enough. No one says, I wish my only regret is I didn't go to work more often on Saturday. You know, if there's any regrets that people have toward the end of their life, it's usually that they either didn't make choices that brought them more happiness or that they were stingy with their lovingness. You know, and again, Hafez says, when all your desires are distilled, you will cast just two votes, to love more and be happy. So knowing that, make that commitment today. That look for opportunities to express your love. Look for opportunities to receive love. And just let it start flowing. Then life is worth living.
One of the most beautiful books that I've ever read, Free to Love, Free to Heal. Heal Your Body by Healing Your Emotions, Dr. David Simon. Thank you, Dr. Simon, so much for this conversation and for writing this book. What a impressive, detailed map to love this is. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kinshasa.
Bye.
We're just beginning, and I know we've each been down this road a time or two. Never could make it through, but I've got this feeling that we stumble into what we've both been waiting for, and maybe even more. It doesn't matter where we've been, 'cause this time I know for sure we're going home. The more you're near me, the more I know it. We got it all here, we just don't blow it. We're going all the way. If the two of us don't want it, I'd lay my money on it. Starting today. Certain that there's more than magic in these feelings that we found. We're standing on solid ground, but now we're both ready for the real thing, 'cause our dues have all been paid. We finally got it made. Believe me when I tell you there's no afraid, 'cause we're going all the way. We're headed for forever, and that's where we're gonna stay. The more you near me, the more I know it. We got it all here. If the two of us both want it, I'd lay my
Have you ever stopped to wonder why children do not concern themselves with all the problems in the world? They seem totally willing to believe that somehow, some way, everything will be fine. And somehow for them, it is. Children do not have philosophical ideas, political positions, or principles to uphold. They know what they know. They accept, and they never try to convince you that what they know is real. Children ask for what they want. They refuse to take no for an answer. And they know that if you say no, Grandma usually says yes. Children will try anything once. They will go anywhere that looks safe. They are not hung up on styles or profiles, positions or postures, power or powerlessness. Yet we believe children don't know, can't do, shouldn't have, can't be, won't make it without us. Isn't it a shame we don't remember as adults that we are always children of God? Affirmation. Today I am a child again. That comes from the book Acts of Faith, Iyanla Vansant.
Do you have chronic pain? Do you know what chronic pain is? Do you know what to do about chronic pain? Chronic pain is generally defined as pain lasting 6 months or more. Subacute pain is pain lasting from 1 to 6 months. Acute pain is generally described as pain of 30 days duration or less. It is estimated between 70 and 116 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. Chronic pain is known to lead to depression, anxiety, and lack of activity. Medications for chronic pain can lead to illness, death, and addiction. There are, however, alternatives to medication for chronic pain sufferers. From chiropractic to diet and exercise to meditation, there are a lot of ways to help reduce, control, or eliminate chronic pain. Researchers from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center wrote in the journal Archives of Internal Medicine that acupuncture has an effect at reducing chronic pain. This conclusion was deduced by analyzing data from 29 different randomized controlled human studies. The authors of this article wrote that they found acupuncture to be superior to both no acupuncture control and sham acupuncture for the treatment of chronic pain. They also stated, "Our results from individual patient data meta-analysis of nearly 18,000 randomized patients in high-quality randomized controlled trials provide the most robust evidence to date that acupuncture is a reasonable referral option for patients with chronic pain." In the same journal, Andrew Evans, MD, wrote, "At least in the case of acupuncture, Vickers et al. Have provided some robust evidence that acupuncture seems to provide modest benefits over usual care for patients with diverse sources of chronic pain." So what is acupuncture? Acupuncture started in China thousands of years ago to treat all ailments. The basis is that we have energy called qi that courses through our body in channels called meridians. The qi should be flowing freely in these channels to provide life energy needed to allow our organs and body to work. If there is a blockage, often called stagnation, in these channels, it can lead to illness. Acupuncturists use thin wire needles to stimulate the flow of energy to restore normal patterns and health. For those afraid of needles, you can relax. Acupuncture needles are nothing like a regular needle used to draw blood or give injections, which are razor sharp, have a beveled tip, and a hole to either put things in your body or take things out. Insertion of acupuncture needles can feel like nothing at all, or like a quick bug bite, having no lasting painful effects. In the modern Western world, it is not exactly understood how this mechanism of pain relief works in scientific principle. However, there is a growing body of evidence that acupuncture does indeed work in many cases, especially with musculoskeletal and chronic pain. As far as my two cents, I use acupuncture regularly in my office and see wonderful results with acute, subacute, and chronic pain, especially if a patient has scar tissue due to injuries such as whiplash, surgery, or broken bones that have healed. As far as how it works, there is a lot of great physiological and neurological hypotheses out there that make a lot of sense on how it stops pain and brings health and energy to people. The bottom line, if acupuncture has worked for people for over 3,000 years, I don't need to understand exactly how it works, but just that oftentimes, acupuncture simply works. This has been a Health Note by Dr. Jonathan Arnold of Arnold Chiropractic and Acupuncture.
It's enough to make make kings and vagabonds believe the very best.
Have you ever stopped to wonder why children do not concern themselves with all the problems in the world? They seem totally willing to believe that somehow, some way, everything will be fine. And somehow for them, it is. Children do not have philosophical ideas, political positions, or principles to uphold. They know what they know. They accept, and they never try to convince you that what they know is real. Children ask for what they want. They refuse to take no for an answer. And they know that if you say no, Grandma usually says yes. Children will try anything once. They will go anywhere that looks safe. They are not hung up on styles or profiles, positions or postures, power or powerlessness. Yet we believe children don't know, can't do, shouldn't have, can't be, won't make it without us. Isn't it a shame we don't remember as adults that we are always children of God? Affirmation. Today I am a child again. That comes from the book Acts of Faith, Iyanla Vansant.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and around the world at kfai.org. The community's true voice.
We really love our Minnesota.
Oh my God, you are so Minnesota.
Guy lived in Duluth.
Duluth, that's in North Dakota.
Well, why not St. Cloud? I mean, I loved growing up in St. Cloud. St. Cloud is a great place to have a childhood.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the kind of music that comes from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
No. Mm.